Okay, so I guess I can just start. So I was asked to lead a discussion on bulk locality, and the only guidance I was given by one of the coordinators was to speak as minimally as possible. So I guess the motivation was that there was recently a set of papers that came out. So what I'll do is, I think my hope is I'll just lay out the setup so that we're all on the same page, and then we can all try to collect a set of facts and conjectures that we can then sort of sort out what is known, what is not known, what can we possibly sort of learn. So we all sort of are getting used to the idea that, well, the CFT, if you know the full CFT, we know the full bulk. We might not know how to extract the bulk, but we expect that the CFT just contains everything. But of course, it's very tricky to figure out how to extract things that are sort of very far away from the boundary, inside black holes and so forth. So one approach to this question of how does the CFT reconstruct the bulk is to ask a sort of more restricted question. If you have a CFT and you have some, let's say this is time, position, and you have just some region, some restricted region on the boundary, how much does this region on the boundary, let me call it say A, how much does the boundary region A know about the bulk? So there are sort of two main questions. Can we reconstruct from the region A? So how much sort of information about the bulk geometry, to be specific, and what I mean by specifying the physics in this region A, I mean I would have access to all the, well, basically to the full density matrix, reduced density matrix of on A. So this really means here the reduced density matrix. So one might, so if I draw the bulk, bulk which is asymptotically, let me take the dimensionality of the bulk to be d plus 1, and then the boundary is just d-dimensional, so this is the d-dimensional boundary, and we have this, so now I have the coordinates sort of time, position, and then the radial coordinates. We have some region A here. How much, what's the region in the bulk that we can fully reconstruct? So there are two sort of logically separate questions. Let me call the region that we can find the full metric from data on A. So call this region R of A. So that's some bulk region here that we can specify, we can extract in principle all the metric components, sort of G, let's say GAB, inside such a region. There's also a weaker question of how much can we probe from A.
Let's
just be classical for now. But we can then sort of try to ask
little steps for little
steps. Little steps for little steps. Well, ultimately one would want to generalize this to quantum, but already we would be at the stumbling block of what we mean by specifying a region. So that there one would have to do something fancier because we don't have a nice notion of continuous space-time, so we would have to even defining this region would be, I mean, the first step to that. But we should make conjectures and ask about that too. So As you'll see, the category of facts will be very little, very depleted. And there's a category of conjectures that's less empty, but it's still sort of mostly about the classical geometry. So let me just call, so this notation was in this UBC paper, so I'll stick to that one. Let me just invent a notation suggested for Probe to call this P of A. So clearly this would include that region, but here you might be able to read of, say, some components of the metric but not others, or some information that this density matrix is influenced by, is sensitive to, but you can't recreate all of the metric. Okay, so that's the sort of main set of questions that if we knew the answer to that, we would be able to sort of invert the relation by sort of saying, well, if we take smaller and smaller regions, maybe we learn how this bulk information is encoded in the CFT, and then we could sort of that way start to understand how to get inside black holes and recover all that sort of information. So let me, instead of asking this question directly, let me just ask what are the simplest classical bulk GR questions. What is sort of the most natural region in the bulk that's associated to this boundary region A? Okay, so this is very ill-defined question as it stands, because I haven't told you what is natural. But once we sort of figure out whether there is some very, very natural construct, we can then try to conjecture, well, does it relate to these quantities or not? Okay, so the most natural, in my view, is something that sort of requires minimal information about the bulk. And one thing that's sort of very basic in Lorentzian geometry is a causal structure. So you might try to ask, can you construct some nice region in the bulk that's just uses the causal structure? And one such construct is the causal wedge. So just to remind all of you of sort of causal sets, causal constructions, if you have some point, let's say P, in spacetime, the future domain of influence of P is the set that's reached by sort of all causal curves, future directed causal curves from P. So we'll label that J plus of P. Similarly for the past domain of influence. If you have a full region, then the domain of influence of that region is just the union of the domains of influence of the individual points in that region. So this would be, if this is, say, the region A, this would be J plus of A, and so forth. There's another concept, which is the domain of dependence, which is the set. So if you have some region, again, A, the set which is causally determined by that region. So if you specify initial data on A, then you can determine, you can evolve, and you know how to evolve, you can evolve within this domain of dependence. Okay, so you might now associate domains of influence and domains of dependence separately for the boundary spacetime and for the bulk spacetime. For the boundary spacetime, well, the domain of influence is of A is this infinite region. Similarly, the bulk domain of influence of A is this sort of set of infinite regions, so that's not very useful in sort of creating some natural minimal set. The domain of dependence in the boundary of A is this distinct looked at from the side. And now again, if you look at the bulk domain of dependence of this region, that's just that region, it doesn't extend into the bulk because you don't have sufficiently high dimensionality. The domain of influence in the bulk of this full region is still infinite. But now there is a nice finite set well, at least finite one on this diagram, which is the intersection of the future with the past domain of influence of this boundary domain of dependence. And that's the causal wedge. So the causal wedge is the set of bulk points, okay, defined such that there is a past-directed causal curve that enters this boundary domain of dependence, and a future-directed causal curve that also enters the domain of dependence. Okay, so that's causal wedge. In our paper, which was this one, we defined this whole bulk region, so domain of, sorry, the causal wedge of A, we labeled
by this, what do you call this?
Diamond. Diamond. No, I mean in, yeah, as a symbol.
Diamond.
Okay. We also call the boundary domain of dependence. Okay, if I draw it here, it would be just this thing. We call that empty diamond. Okay, so. We can call it something else if you guys want. we can call it D of A. I think that doesn't. Okay, so the causal wedge will be the diamond. This is a full codimension zero set. So this is D plus one dimensional in the bulk. This guy is just D dimensional. And of course, A itself is D minus one dimensional. It just has spatial extent. So if one wants to construct a D minus one dimensional bulk region that's somehow very naturally associated with A, a nice construct is just the intersection of this future and past domains of influence. So we called it psi. Sub A, again, if you guys want something else, we can call it something else. But yeah, let me stick to Xi sub A for now.
This is the intersection of the boundary of the future and past?
This is the intersection of J of the future domain of influence of the boundary causal wedge with the past domain of influence of the causal wedge.
With
the boundary taken away. This is still D minus one dimension. It's the same dimensionality as A. It's a space-like surface in the bulk.
It's the intersection of the boundary.
It's the intersection of these null surfaces.
Okay,
so these are null surfaces.
Yeah. Otherwise, everything is intersection.
Sorry, it's the intersection. It's the intersection. Right. This is the intersection of the boundary. Of I plus J plus of D minus D of A with the boundary of J minus of D of A. Break it like that. Minus the sort of boundary points. So it's just this bit. So indeed, that the intersection of the full thing is the causal wedge, so without these boundaries, but the intersection of the boundaries of that is this surface. Okay, so this surface, again, is just defined, given a region A, it's just defined using the causal structure of the bulk. It doesn't need more of the bulk geometry than the causal structure. Well, as we heard from Fei on Tuesday, that's most of the geometry, but not all. So that's a nice, very natural surface, and almost sort of the, I don't know, uniquely nicest surface in my construct. Sort of very simply. That's finite. It's necessarily anchored on the boundary of A.
It's not finite.
What?
It goes to the boundary. Area is never finite. It goes off to. These are finite.
Okay. Good. So, yeah. finite ones you rescale, but okay, that's not as meaningful. But it's not something that would sort of reach very deeply in the bulk. So that's a nice construct. Now, if you do have the full information about the bulk geometry, you can assign nice numbers. Okay, so a natural number would be sort of the proper space-time volume of this causal wedge, and the proper area, well, d minus one dimensional volume of this surface. So we called the area, d minus one dimensional area of this psi, to be called chi, which stood for causal holographic information. But
so
area in Planck units, in bulk Planck units. Of chi A is, we'll call this chi. So this is just a number. Of course, the area, because it reaches to the boundary, is infinite, but the way in which it's infinite is interesting. You can also talk about regulated areas if you do various things, background subtraction or things like that. Just as, okay, there's another very nice number associated with A, which is the entanglement entropy. The entanglement entropy, holographically, is supposed to be related to the area of an extremal bulk surface. So there's another nice construction. So let me just... Okay. Maybe I'll keep drawing it on this. So another nice construction is a, once you have the geometry, not just the causal structure, is an extremal surface. So what should we call this? What do people call this? W of A. So W of A is another d minus one dimensional surface, which is the extremal surface. If you have more than one, then it's the one with minimal area that's deformable to A. Okay, it's a d minus one dimensional quantity anchored on the boundary of A. Okay, so that quantity is also the very natural, and the area of that is the entanglement entropy. It's conjectured to be the entanglement entropy by Ryu and Takayanagi. So area, again, in Planck units of W of A is defined as SA, which is the corresponding to the entanglement entropy. Again, this quantity is also divergent because, again, the surface goes all the way up to the boundary. But again, there's interesting features in how it diverges. Okay, so W of A is a codimension 2 extremal surface, so d minus 1 dimensional extremal surface. And in fact, you can very easily show, at least in some restricted class of spacetimes, that these, the higher the dimension of the surface, of an extremal surface, the deeper it drops. So you might have said, well, there's many natural surfaces obtained by asking, given this domain of dependence D of A, what's the bulk region that's spanned by the set of all extremal surfaces that are anchored within D of A. In fact, that set is contained within just the set that's obtained by taking all of these extremal surfaces. So, in fact, I think Mark called W of A the set of all of them. Yeah.
So does this mean that if I think about Wilson loops and I just mm-hmm. take 2 points and I want to take a string that's sort of packed mm-hmm. into the bulk, that will always lie sort of inside this W of A?
Yes.
Okay, so yes. It won't go as deep.
That's right. That's right.
Sorry. You're in the static case or in the time-dependent?
So, yeah, static, for example.
Yeah. Okay. For the static case, that one can show, that I have shown. But for the time-dependent case, that's just a conjecture. So I haven't proved that.
Because it is true.
It is very likely.
W of A, which is defined as a surface of correlation 1, 2, 2, 2. And if you compare that with higher dimensional surfaces, this one always goes deeper.
Lower dimensional surfaces. If you compare it with lower dimensional, higher codimension surfaces.
Yes.
Then this one goes deeper in static spacetime. The reason is simple to understand. The reason is that it has more dimensions, so the sort of warp factor that makes the area large has more contributions. But what it wants to do is, because at the boundary you have more of this infinity, it wants to get into the bulk as quickly as possible. Sort of quicker when it has more sort of dimensionality on the boundary, and that sort of forces it to go deeper. So that's not clear. So you could probably, if you violate various energy conditions and that sort of thing, and do something exotic, you might be able to construct some situation where, I mean.
But there's a theorem that, given certain positive energy conditions, the bigger surface can't go in farther than the smaller surface. There's a definite ordering to the surfaces.
There's a definite ordering to the surfaces in some restricted class of geometries. Okay, so
what's the class?
Well, certainly it's true for static spacetimes where you have some monotonicity of the metric factors. In fact, it's also true even without monotonicity of some integral of the metric factors. I mean, it's almost.
Those might be constrained by energy conditions.
Sorry?
Those might be constrained by energy conditions, which is what those point to.
I'm just trying to understand what the theory is. Is there a general theorem that says with energy conditions in static space-time, this is true, or are there extra assumptions at the moment? And you said there's some extra assumptions. The assumptions have to do with monoticity of certain quantities, and you don't require lots of symmetry.
So the weakest statement, which is true and easy to show, is if you have a spacetime which is in fact just plane, has planar spherical symmetry and is static, so you have just a function of radial variable, then and monotonicity in this metric function, then it's clear. I think, or actually, just the null energy condition, then it's clear. For more general spacetimes, one can still show various things, but not in any nice. I mean, I don't know of a nice concise statement that would weaken this sufficiently to be interesting. But that's okay. So that's certainly something that one can explore. Yeah, I'm not fully sure whether these guys use W for the full surface, but we'll use this for this. So there's another, apart from this causal wedge, you can also define sort of the D minus one dimensional set that's obtained by the set of all of these. In fact, you can also define a larger set that's obtained by the domain of dependence of the set of all of these. Okay. That, I think, is something that this UBC paper called W hat, which was sort of the set of, I won't write it down, is the set of all of these surfaces and their domain of dependence. Okay, so here are very natural constructs. One might come up with more natural constructs, but now one can start asking, well, do these constructs, in particular this one and this one, anything to do with how much of the bulk you can recover? Yeah.
So one natural thing to do, which I was surprised I didn't see in any of these papers, was something to do with the complement of A. So you might have said the region you probe is something to do with what's insensitive to what's happening to complements, or something like.
In fact, the UBC group sort of tried motivating statements on that.
Something like, you know, if I considered the complement in the bulk of J plus of the complement of A, union J minus of the complement of A.
Yeah, so certainly it's true that that provides an upper bound on R of A. So indeed, so if I draw it, let me try drawing it on the global thing where the complement is. So you have A, and then you have the complement of A, and you have its domain of, I think I'm a bit too ambitious in. Okay, so this is the causal wedge, and you want to take the future of the full causal wedge, or just A of the complement of. Okay, it doesn't. Okay, I guess it doesn't matter so much. So
I was trying to picture this in my head, and I'm thinking.
I mean, the future just starts sort of
J plus union J minus of the complement of A.
That's out a bit too much. Bigger. Yeah, that is out too much because it sort of starts from. At this point, it starts from here rather than started from somewhere like this.
What if I take?
If you take complement of the
J minus of the domain of dependence of the complement of A.
Yeah, so I think that's better, and I think that's still true that that shouldn't influence R of A. That should bound R of A. So you can. So okay. So let's right. So good. So let's call. So if you take J plus of the domain of A complement intersection. Union J minus of the same thing. A complement. That's a good name.
Part of the whole thing.
Okay. Complement of that. Okay, what do you call, want to call it?
S of A.
S of A? It's confusing with entanglement.
We'll call it R of A.
S R of A. S of R of A. Okay, then that indeed, that's something that sort of looks like that also. In some special cases, so by the way, for static.
I mean, it looks like you just drew the causal wedge of A, and SR of A is bigger than that.
So if you have, it can reach.
Is it something bigger? Or?
It's deep. It's bigger even on your original sort of Cauchy surface slice.
For pure radius, it coincides, right? It always coincides. Yeah. So it's okay. Yeah. So indeed. So for pure radius, all of these things. All of these things coincide. Certainly, this one coincides with the causal wedge. But in general, because again, if you have positive energy in the space-time, the null crossing of the space-time is slower in the bulk than through the boundary. So these surfaces will sort of tend to be bent up. So likewise, the causal wedge. Of the domain of dependence will sort of tend to bend down, so the causal wedge might be sort of coming only like sort of slightly less than this one. So in general, one should say that it's easy to show that this guy cannot be nearer to the boundary than this guy. Okay, that you can show by sort of expansions of these surfaces. And I think it should be possible to show that your surface, again, the intersection, or rather this on the, I guess the intersection of the boundaries of these guys reaches more in sort of away from the boundary than A.
Okay.
So there's a hierarchy, which is why this is a sort of an upper bound to what you can probe. Okay, so let me know. Do you want to summarize what the statements for all these papers are?
Three sentences.
Okay,
so
I can get rid of this.
Sentence one is what these folks say. They just say that.
Can you also say what is it going to mean? How much we can reconstruct? What are the quantities that you have in mind when you were doing that? It's because so far it was a purely geometrical description, and you must have in mind something in addition.
Yeah, so in my mind, the statement is that if you are given the data of this Lebesgue matrix, since you can determine everything in the domain of dependence, you should be able to construct all the data of local bulk operators in some region.
By that you mean, for example, two-point functions or fields that live on the geometry?
In particular.
So
it could be all endpoint functions of fields that local bulk fields are living in some region.
Without any additional dynamic information on the CFT?
So the assumption is the CFT is given to you.
Okay, so on top of all this construction, there's an additional construction with the CFT, system-specific CFT.
You know, yeah, I mean, that was already required to say that I can take the data on A to talk about everything inside the domain.
So just to be precise, you just said you know the CFT fully. What you mean for this discussion is you know the CFT fully within D of A.
Yeah. Yes. So I know what. How did it evolve?
That is a very tricky. You cannot, if you think about quantum states and you want to define them on infinitely short geometries, that brings a lot of problems. Because if you think about defining it as a big state, now you restrict by a theta function or something very short the set of operators that you want to have something.
No, you just restrict to all operators smeared with smooth test functions that are supported inside this region.
Okay, we can discuss.
Especially
the smoothing. The smoothing requires additional information about what goes on outside.
Especially for conformal field theory, where these domains of dependence are all. You can just do a conformal transformation and think of this as a field theory on a hydraulic cylinder or something. Some other kind of fancy or
you want to restrict them to a piece of them.
Yeah. Isn't this a standard construction in algebraic quantum field theory to restrict the state to a subset of observables?
Okay, so what are the statements? The statement is that according to the file and friends.
Maybe, are you happier if I insist the restriction is to the interior of the wedge?
Or I don't want to take too much time here, but what I'm saying is that when you're considering restrictions, mm-hmm. you have to know more about the global structure of the theory. And so in addition, so it's not just information on the inside that you're supplying, because if you just try to calculate some quantities, they typically will be reached. So this means that you will have to, for example, if you calculate you have an operator there and you calculate this fault in the end. Want to take too much time, but I have a little bit very specific.
Okay, so
this is our conjecture, or I mean,
this is their conjecture.
Okay,
maybe they will say things differently, but I'm going to say that there are three conjectures in these three papers, and we can see what is this.
RFA is defined as the region within which you can reconstruct the geometry.
That's the definition.
So this would be a theory about this would be a statement about differential equations. I mean, not right. I mean, or is it more than that?
But at a classical level, it would be a statement about differential equations.
Right, which I thought you were working at the classical level.
Yes.
So in some sense, you assume you know the
You want to restruct the classical bulk, or maybe the semi-classical bulk, maybe some correlators in its background.
Yeah.
But you're treating the gauge theory as fully quantum. You want to be
able to use all the
They're not just after the region of the bulk you can restruct. You can reconstruct from the obvious boundary two-point functions.
Well, I was thinking on two points. Suppose you know the leading asymptotic of the metric or some other quantum field, some other bulk field as you approach the boundary in this diamond. Is that enough information to reconstruct the entire solution
some boundary conditions on the interior.
Well, that's what I thought. I was saying that yesterday during Dan's talk.
Yeah.
And I thought that I was convinced of the opposite because within, say, the Grinder wedge, you have a complete mode expansion in that part of A, mm-hmm. where the modes are all determined by the boundary data. So I actually thought of you, and I was hoping, and now I'm being convinced of the opposite.
At least for interacting, at least for scalar fields,
for scalar
treated in perturbation theory. Mm-hmm. It is just a question of PDEs. That in the causal wedge, this construction can be done.
So this is a non-Cauchy problem. I mean, this is something which...
That's right.
It's an unusual Cauchy problem.
Well, it's not a Cauchy problem.
You're specifying they have a time-like surface and trying to evolve in space.
That's right. And to be precise, the statement yesterday was about regions like this in pure ADS space.
Yes.
In principle, one should ask about generalizing the constructions to arbitrary backgrounds. You want to ask it this way.
Yes.
But it seems to me that the basic idea is just that causal wedge is a globally hyperbolic space-time in and of itself. You should be able to expand things there in some set of basis functions. At the physicist level, one might wave one hand and say that presumably they all leave some non-trivial imprint on the boundary and you can do them in the same construction.
But
there's obviously a question.
The causal wedge is only a globally hyperbolic space-time if you supply some boundary conditions on those null surfaces.
No, it's a global hyperbolic space time.
But you need to know data. That one is assuming is given.
Yeah.
But otherwise.
So you have to get data in the bulk on that space like surface, and then you're done.
Right, but that's not what you're given.
You're given data just on the boundary.
Yes.
So I guess there was some discussion, which I missed, about how it is determined just from the data on the boundary.
In the case of pure ADS space.
Yes.
Okay. If you take that causal wedge to be a standard Rindler patch, so if A is an interval in ADS 3 or a disk in higher dimensions, there's an explicit construction that Dan and Gilan and David and everyone have done. Well, actually, they haven't really done this in higher dimensions, but it looks like it should work. It's just find a complete basis of functions in the bulk. They all have nice imprints on the boundary that are distinct, and so you can take the boundary values of your fields, transform them in this basis, and use it to reconstruct them.
There was a set of elasticity game. I mean, so where is that coming in? That you have to evaluate the data, analytic extent, analytic continuation.
As I understand it, that was completely automatic in the following sense. There are two different questions.
Okay.
One is, can I give you arbitrary data on the boundary and construct some bulk solution? The other is, suppose that I give you a smooth bulk solution, is it uniquely specified by its boundary data? Okay. The difference between the two is really, does arbitrary boundary data correspond to any bulk solution? Okay.
Yes.
All right. What I believe their analysis shows is that if you take a smooth solution in the bulk and you look at its boundary data, okay, but that boundary data is automatically analytic in the sense that they need it to be.
So smooth through to the analytic.
Right. Mm-hmm. Where I should specify, is Dan, can you correct me or comment on? Okay. Dan and I had a little discussion afterwards, and I believe the correct statement, and Dan said after the discussion that yes, he agreed with me, is that the analyticity that they really need is analyticity in their spatial coordinates. Right. They talked about writing space time, analyzing the spatial coordinates to some distance into the complex plane at fixed frequency. So the analyticity is really something best viewed by first Fourier transforming in time, and then analyticity in space.
Every Fourier component. every frequency component.
That's right. And the statement is just that if you take a smooth log solution and look at its boundary data, it has that property.
So like a C1 solution in the bulk.
I said smooth, but I think even C1 would do it.
And it turns into analytic.
And it's because the process of doing this transform, because of the way the mode functions work, is like doing a Fourier transform and then multiplying the answer by e to the minus k to some number. And if you do that to a Fourier transform, it becomes analytic.
I see. Okay, that's really interesting.
Yeah, and it's enlightening. It seems like it's a strange thing, but if you say it that it's analytic at fixed frequency, it's much less mysterious. Because an important just touching point here to make yourself feel better is to think about the case where it's not sort of a render wedge, but it's the whole Poincaré patch. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the degenerate render case. In that case, their statement is actually that the corresponding functions are analytic in the space directions over the entire complex plane. In the render wedge, you only get up to a finite place in the complex plane or some script. But that script becomes infinitely big in the Poincaré patch. Mm-hmm. And your first reaction, of course, that's ridiculous. How can it be? It's actually obviously true in the way that I just said. The point is that if you're working now in pure ADS, for any scalar field of an allowed mass, when you look at its spectrum, well, you know that first, because it's pre-stable, its spectrum is always time-like. There are only modes with omega squared greater than k squared. There are no modes with k squared greater than omega squared, where I'm speaking about boundary length and boundary frequencies.
Yeah.
Okay. Otherwise, it'd be a tachyon, it'd be stable.
Right, by positivity of the Hamiltonian.
Exactly. So it's just true that omega k squared is not bigger than omega squared. Uh-huh. So if you look at fixed frequency, there are no components at large k. It's compactly supported in momentum space. Mm-hmm. So yes, in position space, it's analytic over the entire plane. Okay. So there's an explicit example where you can just see it working out, and it appears to be a similar story in the render patch, except that there you're actually guaranteed less. You only guarantee you can go partway onto the complex plane. So the analyticity, I think, is, I mean, I don't think it's something to dwell on. It's not deeply mysterious. It just comes out of the fact that any solution in the bulk universe which is not analytic has data on the boundary which is analytic in this sense, analytically, at fixed frequency. If you look at fixed time, it's of course not analytic. You can just take the t equals zero slice, you could write down arbitrary initial data, solve the Cauchy problem, you could make the initial data smooth or C3 or something not analytic, and you can choose it to be not analytic on the boundary at that time. But once you Fourier transform in time, it becomes analytic in space.
So there must be some way of recasting the thing is just on the data, on the real surface. I mean, there must be some...
And there is. Yeah. There is. I mean, it depends what you want to do, but as I think, as Dan agreed during the discussion, if you're willing to just take the boundary data and first Fourier transform it and then do some bulk integrals, you can do it all in real space. The process is equivalent to analyzing the data. And so, and indeed, if you want to quote, if you want a simple compact formula where you don't have to worry hard about orders of operations, their analytic extension of the complex plane is a prettier formula. But yes, it can be all be done in real space.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. So then the question is whether this process generalizes to an arbitrary fact. That's not completely clear. It's a great project, I think, for someone, maybe a serious mathematician, to even try to prove under what circumstances it works. But the elements of the basic elements of the construction appear to be there for any causal wedge. The causal wedge is a globally Hamiltonian spacetime. There is some basis of solutions. Okay. The only thing which is really critical in their construction is that the basis of solutions. Is that sort of every element of the basis of solutions induces distinct data on the boundary in some appropriate sense. Maybe there's some sense in which those things have to be orthogonal on the boundary, I'm not exactly sure, but it doesn't smell to me like there's something really important about ADS, pure ADS arrays coming into play. I could be wrong. Oh, I should say there are other cases where you can certainly do it.
What
flat space? Well, you can do it, for example, flat space. Where's the boundary?
It's just in the middle of space.
I think you can.
Basically, you're saying anything heading towards the boundary from the left will pass through it. I mean, in some sense, that's the...
That's the basic idea, yeah. I know you can do it in any case which is asymmetric space across time. So for example, outside of a hyperbolic black hole, you can do their construction, and it works just fine.
But that is what does the Riemann done differently?
But isn't that...
No, Riemann done differently is a particular temperature hyperbolic black hole. My statement is that for an arbitrary hyperbolic black hole, you can do it. So you can at least generalize, you know, to some amount. The construction that I would write down that would be simple involves having a space with some amount of symmetry. But it's, again, it's an interesting research project to generalize it, but I personally am ready to believe that it works.
I mean, another direction is to say, well, one should insist on there being a prescription that does generalize, because it shouldn't work just for pure ideas or these special cases.
Sure.
And one might ask, what is a construction that, how far do we want it to be generalizable? Certainly it should be arbitrary, asymptotically ADS spacetime with some energy conditions and so forth, but how exotic should one get? And does that constrain what we can do for the reconstruction?
Yeah. But Joe's quite right that at this level, taking boundary data and reconstructing the bulk geometry inside the causal web, it probably is a question of PDEs.
But it's another part of the problem. If you only knew that boundary data to the highest accuracy, then you could recover a singular bulk and walk in a long-term small area.
Well, that's an interesting
question. You can give the boundary data to infinite precision.
So how stable is it, or how unstable is it?
Well, I think the reason is that, ill-posed means that there are arbitrarily small perturbations of boundary data would lead to a problem arbitrarily close to the boundary.
As long as you have to impose this analyticity, that time was
following this.
Well, but that's an important point. If you're given that the boundary data is the boundary data of some solution,
exactly, yes.
Then the problem is this.
Exactly, yes.
Well, if you know it corresponds to some solution, there are two different questions. One is if you know it corresponds to some solution, but it may not be. How do I want to say this? Suppose you haven't distinguished between boundary data corresponding to solution X and boundary data corresponding to solution Y, but that you have bounded the difference in their boundary data in a small way. Can solution X and Y actually be very different?
I think they
can. They can.
Because close to the analyticity many times corresponds to putting boundary conditions on horizons, right? In Riemann, for example, the analyticity going through, I don't know if it's the same analyticity. So usually you need to have some regularity conditions on the horizon so that you can restrict the class of classical solutions that are allowed. I think this is similar to what Harry was.
Well, no, I mean, you can just ask, can you go epsilon from the horizon in and get close enough space-time? I think
how do you measure the precision that you know the boundary data? But if you think about it in this mode some way, if you knew the coefficients of each mode to some reasonable tolerance, I think it's pretty clear that you can reconstruct the solution near the boundary to reasonable accuracy.
Well, we might have problems with the mode some in the first place. A mathematician would get the Fourier transform in time. When does that exist? The function to be decaying to the future in the past.
Well, you need it to be, if it's bounded to the future and past, then the Fourier transform exists in some distributional sense.
But why should it be bounded?
I think
it's coming back to some analyticity.
But there are other ways to reconstruct the metric than just from this mode decomposition. You might look at null geodesics that start on the boundary and end on the boundary within that region. Those are given by Balcom singularities. Those would be sensitive reasonably nicely. So if you change the boundary data a bit, the bulk would also change a bit, but not drastically.
Can I ask one question just to clarify? In this simple example of flat space, flat plane boundary,
yes.
Ordinary scalar field,
yes.
The data that you have to specify presumably can't be like Neumann boundary conditions. It has to be Dirichlet boundary conditions?
It's both.
Mm-hmm.
The point is that to define the CFP here, you choose a boundary condition. So you make the CFP satisfy, say, here are some boundary conditions. And then the information, the additional information about this CFP state you're using to construct the bulk is what is the value of the operator, which is the bad, which is the other bulk. So you know both.
Okay.
So more of, there is indeed the Cauchy problem turned on its side, which is how Harvey says the principle will pose, there is really some issues.
I know that in this case, it doesn't work.
Well, it would be very interesting to quantify those and find out what the issues are.
Has to have some integrity condition, something, sample question.
Okay, so should we go into that tool?
Okay, what do those guys do? Okay, so see that. Is that a statement we can extract from here, from this discussion, which says that what we mean by reconstructions, that would be useful? Because none of the papers make any statement about what reconstruction means. So there is this region.
The one that I was volunteering is that if you know, I guess it's the two leading asymptotes of the fields at D of A, that you can construct the fields classically everywhere in the bulk. Now, I want to make a distinction because Raphael never talks about A, they talk about D of A only.
Yes.
So there's this extra step of constructing D of A from A in the boundary. So sometimes I guess that's a given, although it leads to saying things in different ways. Yeah. And so in particular, it's not enough to know local invariants on A, you know, the whole state on A, the whole density.
Yeah. Yes. So that was the assumption, that you do know the density matrix.
Right.
And then you're evolving with respect to how much.
And I think the difference between Raphael's paper and the other papers is basically that Raphael was more worried about having partial information of the CFT Hamiltonian, whereas the other papers were basically mostly concerned with having partial information about the state. So they were just saying, okay, you're going to find out the state on this part of the space flex slicing. Implicitly assuming that I know what the CFT Hamiltonian is.
Yes. Okay, more explicitly
worried about it. What if I don't know what the CFT Hamiltonian is
outside of the
UA? So Raphael considered geometries which were not of the form of DNA, but I suppose they could be unions of DNAs, which might be enough to.
What do you have?
Well, Raphael had, in particular, the strips.
Yes.
Where he knows the whole initial data surface, but he assumes after some time he doesn't know what the CFT Hamiltonian is doing.
That's what
I mean when I say he's more interested in the problem of, I don't know what the evolution rule is.
No, it's not a D for any A. Well, if you take a bunch of short A's and short diamonds, and then you put them next to each other, you can make a strip out of them all. I think it probably is contained within this union.
Yeah. Raphael was interested in looking at in global areas, strip of time of width.
That's right.
Two T, and then asking how much.
But that wouldn't be the union of DLAs for disjoint A's.
Well, continuous set of A's, so that each domain of dependence
would just... But it is a different question.
But for this question, I think Raphael did say that what you can construct is just the reconstruct.
What do you have to know in RMA or D of A? You have to know multi-point functions? I mean, in the CFT, what are you supposed to know about whole density? But if you don't talk about the spatial slice, I guess you're saying it's more like equivalent to know all the multi-point functions and know the density matrix. I guess that's...
Yeah, all correlation functions of all operators.
But including non-local operators?
Yeah, as long as you're all of the observables associated with that D of A region in the CFT.
Right.
Includes Wilson loops inside of the
UK. Because you know, it's roughly like knowing the state and knowing the evolution operator.
I guess I'm asking you another question, but how much do you have to know to reconstruct the density matrix? But maybe that's a question for another time.
You know the state.
It's a reduced density matrix is something that acts on the algebra operators associated with that region.
Right.
If you know the values of all of the operators in an algebra, that's what you need to know to reconstruct the density matrix.
Now, actually, you need to know less, right? You can just compute the moments of a reduced density matrix, what people call Renyi entropies.
No, that doesn't tell you the whole
thing. No, up to unitary transformation, it tells you what the reduced density matrix is.
Yes, up to unitary transformations, which are important. The unitary transformations might change what happens in the bulk.
But in some unitary frame, you can write down the reduced density matrix given the moments.
you can write down the eigenvalue.
You can write the eigenvalue.
And in this classical notion, if you just knew some low-level multi, you know, some multi-point functions of the stress tensor and stuff like that, that thing is feeling, that would be enough.
Yeah, in the PDE sense, we're just thinking of knowing the one-point function.
That's, okay.
Again, so what is it that we want to reconstruct? The metrics and geometry, some...
Yeah, so let's say we're just doing pure gravity, we should be able to reconstruct the metric.
From density matrix, the density matrix on the...
On this.
On this. There will be a function that were a function of now the R, a function of R and the functions that define the correlation function on the boundary, that will give you the metric.
In fact, you might only need, say, the set of all chi's, this areas, for all little subregions within that region.
So it's somehow a generalization of the holographic RG. You want to find that in some flow that moves you from the boundary into the bound?
Yeah, you can just take larger and larger subintervals and get larger and larger W's,
okay,
as well.
Yeah.
Create a whole surface.
And the new ingredient in this construction is that with respect to the orographic area.
Well, I don't see immediate similarities to holographic RG, but I should say that in holographic RGs, you can, as far as I understand, you can write bulk radial evolution equations in a form that's reminiscent, in fact, in some cases, directly like RG equations. But there's an important question there, which is how do you translate that information of where you are in the bulk to the scale in the field theory? So what do you mean? What is happening? But I think that's a different question.
Because what, if I understood correctly, you want some equation that tells you what is, the metric as a function of the
obvious data,
yes, and something that goes in between. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so this is one statement, or one sentence. The second sentence is what the UBC people said, that R of A, they had, can be bigger than the causal wedge. And in particular, in certain cases, it can be as big as what Veronica described as W hat of A. Okay, so this is some bulk region that's, roughly speaking, the domain of dependence of this extremal surface in some region of this kind. And that they argued by saying that, well, but if you know the density matrix, then you know the entanglement entropy. So in principle, you should be able to see so far. And therefore, given data about entanglement entropies of various subregions inside A, be able to reconstruct at least this much. And then there's some special subcases where they think it might even be bigger than this, but they're not sure. But this is their minimal statement, that they would think that you should be able to reconstruct more than the causal wedge, and in particular, inside this domain of dependence of the experience.
But couldn't you try to falsify this by PDEs? I mean, if the PDEs, yes, problem is, as you say, this should fail, is that?
Yeah.
But
they might be using more than the PDE information. I mean, PDE information we were given just basically the one-point function.
Mm-hmm.
And now they're saying, okay, you can't do it just with the one-point function, mm-hmm, but if you use extra information,
right,
maybe you
can. I see.
Yeah.
So there might be some...
I mean, again, the idea could be... Again, the idea could be that you just use the entanglement entropies for all subregions within that,
right,
thing, and so that tells you if you use neighboring ones, basically you sort of bootstrap your way of recovering the bulk metric all the way up to where these services reach.
So you could try to find two different classical solutions that fail at the level of PDEs, trying to look for some signal at higher orders and one over n squared or something.
So I think it's even, I'm not sure even if it's one over n squared, it could even be classical from the way Veronica said.
That's a PDE question.
But I mean, is entanglement entropy a PDE question?
But you know, also, even the Wilson line, if you measure the Wilson line, you say it hangs further in.
Yes.
So that's something that's already.
Yeah, that's already.
So it seems to me that it's somewhat surprising that WA, you know, reaches outside of this wedge, because, you know, what if there was like a gravitational wave that was floating by that was originated?
Yeah.
You know, so it seems like that would mess with W of A, the length of it, but somehow, you know,
you would not
it's
be able
the turn
to
of
it.
Yeah.
But these extremal surfaces would pass through that region, their areas would get deformed,
right.
So they would not go there.
Yeah, I mean, that's just thinking about, you know, if you were trying to, make a counterexample, you would have some funny thing going on.
Making a counterexample is difficult to control, because if you look at the complement of A in the field theory, or in the boundary, and you look at the corresponding causal diamond from that, so if you ask, if you ask where you can
right,
do things in field theory
yes.
that don't influence the field theory state inside DNA,
yes.
It turns out you can show that those influences can never reach the surface WA in the moment. That WA, you see WA is causally shielded
yes.
from A.
Yes.
Right.
The diagram. Well, of course, W of A is also W of the complement of A by construction. So the same picture shows that it's causally shielded from basically anything else.
Well, then it sounds like we're on our way to proving.
Well, no, it's a consistent conjecture at this level.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's no simple case.
Yeah. So one reason that they don't go ahead and fully claim that this is possible is that they have some examples in where by just looking at the set of all extremal surfaces, they find that there's a hole in the middle left in the space. They can't probe all of space-time. Okay, so the extremal surfaces sort of are shielded from some core region. And these are in some boson star-like examples.
But in ADS, it's not surprising. I mean, if you start making multi-throat geometry, it's not surprising
yes.
you can hide things in
yes.
places.
Yes.
But
it's just a boson star.
This is a single core geometry.
It's not multi-throat geometry. It's not topological structure.
Yes.
And in pure ADS, actually, do they know that this doesn't happen in pure ADS? If you choose in higher in dimensions greater than ADS 3, if you choose complicated regions, do you know that?
Oh, I guess you're saying that.
No,
Don wants to take some complicated region on the boundary.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then he wants to know if you can sort of go all the way to the center of ADS by taking a region large enough. That would be one.
Yeah, I want to take complicated region A on the boundary, because there are also the complement of A.
Yes.
And I want to know if you do anything you can from the standpoint of either A or the complement of A, and you consider these entangling surfaces, do they go all the way to the center? Or if you choose surfaces with funny boundaries?
Yeah, because you can choose within your region, well, unless it's some fractal region or something like that. Okay, so if you choose some weird fractal region.
No, smooth, but just not a disk.
Yeah, then you could put disks within it that would sort of populate from one side or from the other side.
So in my complicated A, I can choose a disk, but the complement of that disk is not an allowed choice because it includes both part of my region
yes.
A and part of my region A bar. So it's not obvious, it's not immediately obvious to me that by doing things just inside of A or just inside of this A bar, I can actually probe.
I see. So you say, okay, if you have some, say, tennis ball type set partition.
Tennis balls are round.
No, the seams on the tennis ball, right?
Oh, I see.
Tennis ball is the boundary.
Yes.
Some seams on it that sort of doesn't.
It's not obvious.
Nested in some way.
Okay. The other confusing technical point about this discussion is that in the paper, the UBC group argued that these surfaces have some nice properties in static space-times.
Yes.
Now, I wanted to ask the PDE experts here, I guess it's Harvey. You know, if you're solving...
That's the first time we've described it. It's all relative.
Keep them on the block, the one-eyed man.
If you're looking for static solutions to the Klein-Gordon equation, these are, of course, solutions to the massive Laplace's equation. Okay? Those solutions, any solution is analytic. Solutions to Laplace equations are analytic functions.
Yeah.
Is it also true in GR, in general, with horizons and so forth, that any static solution is analytic? I would suspect
so. There is some theory to that effect. I don't know what the precise conditions are.
Right, with some context.
Well, you can rewrite Einstein's equation for static space times
as some of those
equations, and you have it like a Laplace equation on the norm of the Killing field, and then a Ricci tensor related to the derivative of the norm.
So non-linear PDEs and certain operations, you might have horizons and so forth, but
they're all elliptic equations.
Yeah.
Solutions are usually.
So the solutions should be analytic. So my point is that you know, they've shown that these surfaces have nice properties in some context where if it's a solution, the solution is necessarily analytic, and
so then we know everything.
Then you know everything from any small region. Just by PDEs.
Sure.
So the question of how nicely these surfaces behave in dynamical contexts is a very interesting one.
But, I mean, they're still solutions to PDEs in the dynamical context.
They are.
Yes, because they're extremal surfaces in the bottom.
They are.
So by definition, they're just surfaces where the null expansions going out towards the boundary in both directions is zero. So that's a simple PDE that you can write down.
To solve it. Is this all done for temperature zero?
You can do it for non-zero temperature.
I wonder, let's say you do it for a temperature where there are two classical configurations. Let's say AGS and the black hole.
Yes.
How do you know which one you are attaching? Which are you building? Mm-hmm.
I mean, don't you know already from the stress tensor?
No, but how do I know from the information
that
here
that
which one to continue, which one to continue?
Exactly.
Good question.
Sorry, you have the CFT information, so you know if there's a temperature in the CFT, right?
No, but I think Eliezer's question is that if I knew the full CFT, then it's a question of just looking at the free energy and telling myself, oh, I see,
if you know my patch, you only know what the temperature is.
Well, even ordering large N, the entropy is either zero or it's not.
Yeah, I think.
this order of analysis, I mean, it's clear, isn't it?
I think that there's probably one way to tell. I'm not sure this will work, but so if you just compute the entanglement entropy of the radiant density matrix, I mean, it will have some characteristic UV divergence or some local CFT physics. But if your state is not pure, if your total CFT is in some density matrix itself, then it will get a contribution, some IR contribution, that's related to the temperature. So in principle, you can use that data to try to extract what the entropy is of the full density matrix. So you'll have to look in the entanglement entropy to see what the IR pieces are. And from that, you might be able to tell which phase you're in. Okay, but I don't know if this reconstruction has ever been carried out in detail. I mean, it seems obvious to do from the geometric side, but your question is how will you do it given the field theory?
Remedial question. WA depends on metrical data, not just on causal data.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So it's something that's less beautiful. I'll retract. It depends on metrical data.
But to be fair, at the end of the day, if you're trying to associate numbers to either surface, then it depends on the metrical data.
But it seems like from what people have said, it's almost certain that using this Wilson Lupin example that there should be some way that you can probe minimal surfaces even when you're deeper than
But the question is, do the minimal surfaces in that context tell you anything about do the minimal surfaces actually tell you the expectation value of an operator in the gauge theory in that context?
Sounds like Wilson Loops are a good candidate.
Well, so
is that not right?
The store, my understanding is that we only believe the geodesic approximation to the two-point function or the area approximation to the Wilson Loop observable in a context where the classical space-time is analytic, in which case the information is actually contained near the boundary.
No.
Yes.
Why not?
You said this about me.
I think we should leave the floor to George.
The proposal didn't require, I mean, the whole proposal, let's do it calculating Wilson.
The Wilson Loop case, I'm less familiar. Two-point function context, let me discuss the two-point function, okay? Suppose you consider a...
Oh, well, two-point functions, I agree. In order to get that related to a space like geodesic, you need large masses.
But
large
masses. No, I don't want to. I never wrote a paper about that. I thought you believed that this went beyond analytic.
For the two-point function?
Well, for space like geodesics, not
the... For space like geodesics, exactly. Yeah. That's the context where it reaches past this surface. For causal geodesic, time-like or null, it can't go out of the causal...
I right. Now I'm getting...
Yes, yeah, for space like
geodesics. I'm sorry, I...
Time-like ones are going to be tweaking.
It's related to space like geodesics.
Yes.
It requires some analysis. That's in right. The bulk.
In the bulk. Right. And that's the only context in which it can go far.
But you said...
I mean, if you have a bulk, it can go further. But you could do non-analytic things in the bulk somewhere else.
If I have two points on the boundary that are causally related on the boundary,
yes,
and I consider a causal curve that connects them in the bulk, it lies inside your causal
edge. Yes,
agree.
Yes.
So the only case where a two-point function in the geodesic approximation could potentially probe farther than W of A, which lies outside of D of A, is if the two points are space-like related and you're looking at space-like geodesics. And we agree that in that context, you need analyticity in the bulk space-time for this to be a good approximation.
Yes.
And
the word analytic doesn't appear in our paper.
Doesn't it?
Not the way it's in there.
It does appear
in that dies.
It does appear in the sense that you try to dismiss it immediately.
anyway,
we can let you go on.
The question was whether Wilson Loops are better than two-point functions.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Local operators. And I think we claimed it was the same story.
Right. So the two-point function also reaches deeper, you're saying?
Yeah. For space-like.
No, we agree they're not better. But I guess the two-point is the two-point function is also good. It also tells you more than the one-point functions. So
Yes. Well, it reaches deeper, but only in cases where it's not the right. Sorry, the geodesic that when you would use to approximate it, you would use, reaches deeper, but only in cases where you don't believe the approximation.
Ooh, I see.
Why don't you believe
the approximation? Because the way you derive the approximation. There's a mathematician's answer.
This should be finished completely.
Okay. The mathematician's answer, which I will not go into in detail, which is the only way that I know how to derive the approximation is by using analyticity. Okay. That's not really a good answer. The good answer is that the kind of things we're talking about are simple two-point functions of a local operator at the boundary that you think of as being dual to a bulk scalar field. Right. We're talking about them in the large approximation.
Large
n is the important point here.
Yeah.
So in this approximation, that boundary two-point function is the boundary value of some bulk two-point function.
Yes.
Okay? It's a two-point function in the bulk defined in the approximation where you use quantum field theory and a fixed space-time background because you're at large n.
Right.
That's a causal theory.
Yeah, okay.
That's basically the answer. So that two-point correlator, say in bulk, cannot be sensitive to data which is really outside of this, which is not does not intersect that causal wedge. It's just local quantum field theory. It's causal. So if you had a geodesic to probe deeper, and if it gave you some answer that was not in fact determined by what was here, say by analyticity or something, it would be wrong. And I understood, maybe we had a miscommunication here, the same story was true of Wilson loops, but more or less the same.
What about the entanglement entropy?
Entanglement entropy is not, obviously, it's an interesting question whether or not the proposal that you guys have made is correct in non-analytic cases. You might raise that question based on the geodesic approximation two-point functions issue or the Wilson loop issue. But there it's much less obvious what the right answer is, because the entanglement entropy of the full reduced syntheses matrix and the full CFT is not something you expect to be able to compute using quantum fields in curved space-time in that approximation.
This was the what I was alluding to when we had the discussion about the smoothing and so on.
Okay, we can talk about that more later. So because the quantity you're after is not something that's obviously computable in the bulk from this wedge, which is local quantum field theory, it's not obviously incorrect to propose that this entangling surface is really given by the minimal surface. It's not obviously incorrect to prove that the true entanglement entropy is given by the minimal surface, even in non-analytic cases. But it's an interesting question.
Why is it so different from the Wilson loop case?
Well, the Wilson loop case, I'm not an expert on, so I'm going to punt on that.
I would say the difference is the two-point function or the Wilson loop, and I believe this is still true for the Wilson loop, is the boundary limit of some bulk of Girard.
Is that really true for the...
But you could have said...
No, not the Wilson loop is just some string work.
I mean, there's no obvious... loop operating in there.
I think the claim is it's not just a string, a space-like string world sheet, just like, I mean, that's the point, right?
We use this
I think what Don and you guys said in your paper was that in analytic space-times, that's the thing, but it really in a dynamic space-time, that's not an approximation. It's determined by causal data.
Right? It's unfortunate that Steve Giddings is not here, because the paper that we cite is by him, and I think we cited it as saying that my story about two-point functions carries over to this case. I don't know exactly what it said, but clearly it's some story about thinking of these Wilson loops as having to do with dynamical strings in the bulk.
Yeah, I think in any case, that story, to whatever extent it applies to Wilson loops, clearly doesn't apply to entanglement entropy to the same extent. There's no bulk observable that you can compute.
Oh, they said
the
extremal
surface.
The entanglement entropy is the boundary limit.
But that's just the surface.
What's interesting to me is, you know, it is some complexified geodesic, right? I mean, usually you think of some high mass two-point function, let's say, you know, some complexified geodesic somewhere. And maybe that.
Why complexified?
Well, if it's a causal. Maybe
it's also interesting to think about complexifying geodesics. Yes.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you do have analyticity in the boundary theory, and so it's interesting to continue a two-point function everywhere you can. And what's the interpretation of that?
You have analyticity of the correlation functions in the vacuum.
That's right.
Right.
Or but even in a even in the state. In many states.
In many states. I can build states where they're not analytic. I think if I just take the vacuum and I act on it with an operator smeared with some smooth but non-analytic function, do I get non-analytic correlates?
I guess the question is the kinds of things that you might, if you can use the Kabat, the Lefschetz et al. Proposal, I think you want to be in states where things are analytic.
But isn't that just a thermal state?
So if you restrict yourself to that sense, then you can sort of ask what continuing two-point functions everywhere you can.
I want to just repeat what I said. If you look at data which is analytic, first, just a free scalar field, say, you look at data which is analytic in the Kabat, Lifshitz, Lowe sense.
Yes.
Okay, the sense they actually need for their construction.
Yeah.
The corresponding bulk solution is in general smooth, C3, it's not analytic.
Right.
And what I'm talking about here, what you need, as far as I understand, for this geodesic approximation for space-like geodesics to be correct for two-point functions.
That's bulk analytic.
Is bulk analytic.
Right, which is much different.
Which is much stronger.
Yeah, but I mean, sort of, if you back up, it's interesting to say what boundary analyticity means, continuing the boundary points everywhere you can in the complex boundary planes, and you know, that those should have interpretations in terms of something in the bulk.
Yeah.
I mean, away from the simple smearing function. I mean, there has to be some bulk interpretation of that.
It sounds like the comments about ill-posedness, that maybe it's something to do just with the existence of a bulk description, more than epsilon into bulk.
Yeah.
Right, but you might think that means that singularity, that some problem in the boundary corresponds to some bad problem in the bulk. Some lattice of C3 or something.
Steve, I must be missing something. We're fixing the metric on the boundary. So it's easy to imagine you fix an analytic metric on the boundary, that's not going to change or be dynamical, but the metric inside is very dynamical and doesn't have to be analytic at all, right? It just needs to asymptotically approach an analytic metric.
Well, but if you imagine some state in the boundary CFT that's time evolving and computing correlators in the boundary dynamics, that would be the question.
Okay, so you want all the evolution of the time dependent stuff to be analytic?
What's actually being approached in this case is the analyticity of the boundary metric and also analyticity of, say, the boundary stress tensor.
Right.
Again, both pieces of Cauchy data are being stressed.
But you don't just want the flat CFT.
Right. So that's.
The lesser side steps in these opposing issues. So you can't consider small perturbations and complex support on the boundary.
Yes, you certainly cannot consider generic function perturbations of small compact support on the boundary. Absolutely true.
It's not quite strict.
Yeah.
I am concerned by this focus on analyticity because it's just such a precise requirement. I mean, first, are we analytic? I don't know. but I think the real issue is that in a time-dependent background,
yes,
this connection between Wilson loop devs and space-like surfaces breaks down.
That's
it's simply time-dependence, I think, is it? Even if it's analytic, there's some other way maybe you could reconstruct the geometry, but this particular way fails if it's even time dependent in general.
What is the reason for this breaking down?
Because our intuition that a path integral is dominated by a surface of minimum area comes from the Euclidean context, and once you have time dependence in the Lorentzian context, there's in general no simple Euclidean version of that question.
Oh, yes, that's
right. I think for the two-point function, you actually can do it in analytic time-dependent context. You do have to carefully chase what minimal surface through what, I don't know. You have to worry about, you have to watch where the contour goes carefully. But I think it does actually work.
Yeah, I think the point is for the two-point function, you really only need subset analytic continuation to something that's real on the curve rather than a real metric in the space.
So what is the kind of evidence that W of A is reconstructible as opposed to, I guess, R of A? I mean, just there's this entropy counting idea. But in a time dependent place where you don't use space like geodesics or worldsheets,
Well, you can clearly get some of the metric because if you have the lengths of all the geodesics, like you can.
Which geodesics?
Which is the extremal curves that go from space like separated points in B of A. And you can, you know, use them to foliate various surfaces in that, you know, W hat.
But where do you get the space like geodesic information?
Well, you calculate the entanglement entropy from little subregions in B of A.
This is space like geodesic, it's this extremal surface.
It's the extremal surface.
Steve, were you asking the question, what's the evidence that the area of WA actually gives the correct entanglement entropy in these time-dependent contexts?
I guess maybe I should have been asking that question. given that statement, that's a whole big idea because it.
And there was a paper today.
Yes.
Right. They found evidence in support of your guys' proposal.
So there are many pieces of evidence for just entanglement entropy formula. So and we can go back to asking what we believe about the Utah and argument.
Mm-hmm. For static and time dependent.
For the moment, just static space times.
Okay.
For static states. So why do we believe minimal surfaces do the job?
Okay, but there's this whole in static spaces that it seems like objects work well.
They work well, but as far as entanglement, as far as the specific question of entanglement entropy is concerned, there is a lot of evidence, but there's no proof that entanglement entropy is computed by minimal area surfaces.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Now, but among the various pieces of evidence is one piece which works in its paper is that it satisfies entropy inequalities of the kind that Lieb and company proved many years ago.
Right.
The subadditivity inequality.
And that's known in the time-dependent case as well, or is this
not? So in the time-dependent case, the problem, which, so in the static case, it's very easy to prove by just deforming surfaces, because they're all minimal, you deform it and use minimality to prove it. In a time-dependent case, even if you have a region anchored here, you sort of look at two regions,
yes,
the extremal surfaces go on different planes in the bulk.
Yes.
So it's hard to compare their areas and deform them. And today, Matt Hedrick and his collaborators show that in a specific context of ADS3 YGAP,
yes,
the extremal surface prescription does satisfy some of the activity,
assuming
non-energy condition.
Yes. Yes.
Okay, so it adds evidence,
yes,
that this extremal surface prescription,
yes,
is something like an entropy in certain context,
yeah,
but it doesn't give you a foolproof. But I should add, there's one more piece of evidence if you don't really believe time dependence. At least for stationary space solutions, we have an explicit construction to show that the extremal surface is the right thing to consider in the ADS3 case, rotating B2C geometries.
Okay, but it seems like the biggest challenge, from what I understand, is where you can't go to some Euclidean continuation is
yes,
time dependence.
Yes.
Okay, so I guess maybe.
Yeah. So I would say that one has to take identifying WA with entanglement entropy in general,
yes,
with a pinch of salt. With a pinch of solids. It's not a rigorously proved statement that we know in general.
So do you want to get your third sentence?
Yeah. It's a little shorter than the first and second. In some sense, what we said was, well, you should at least be able to reconstruct the causal wedge. You may be able to do more, but we don't know how.
But you just told me that.
Well, okay, so what we said was that one thing you can do to reconstruct the causal wedge,
yeah,
is to try to use the area of that surface that we define to try to cook up, take various subregions and use that to build up some observable that you can use to explicitly construct the bulk metric inside the causal wedge. So we were trying to say that not only should you be able to reconstruct the data inside the causal wedge, but you could use this observable, which is the area of this surface, which I should say we did not define what it means in the field theory. I don't know what this area means.
Are you quoting which surface you're
quoting? The yellow one, the orange one. What the runner called psi A. The surface that lies on the boundary of the causal wedge. So if that can be identified with a sensible observable in the field theory, we were trying to argue that observable could be useful to reconstruct the geometry inside the causal wedge.
But only, of course, inside the causal wedge.
Inside the causal wedge.
Yeah.
I guess there's something which is bothering me about this whole discussion. I mean, you proved that extremal surfaces can't penetrate into horizons.
Yes.
So but even using
static geometries.
Static geometries. Okay. Well, let's give static. So even using the more generous notion of W, this would say that we could never reconstruct physics inside our horizon.
Yes.
Whoa, I'm confused. Mm-hmm. If you form the black hole by collapse, why
static
is it?
Static geometries. So indeed, you can get past the horizon in dynamical collapse where the horizon is
shallow. In particular, so the minimal surface is always trivial. It's zero area in any case we have a collapsing black hole. Okay.
So is the answer static space times are analytic, so I can always know what's happening inside the black hole by looking a little bit near infinity, and in time-dependent space, times I get inside the horizon because these surfaces just go inside.
But only a bit. I mean, I don't think you can get anywhere near the singularity with them.
So if we believe that everything inside the horizon is captured by the CFT,
Then there must be some other observable. And I take a surface that spans from line A out to the point, that's a Cauchy surface in the boundary, I now take its dimension dependence, and you'd be seeing
the plane
where you construct the entire ball, all the way to the singularity.
Yes, so W hat, but the extremal surfaces are not going to reach to the
Any point in the, any single point in the bulk is an equally good extremal service. It could be, I can take them arbitrarily near a singularity. I'm not sure what, why we need to worry about this, but.
If the extremal surface is fully anchored on the boundary.
I'll take the case where A is a Cauchy surface of the boundary. It isn't, it's not anchored in any sense, it's just.
A full Cauchy surface.
Are you saying the limit is discontinued? Global ADS, let A be some, you know, some constant time slice in global ADS, a slice of the cylinder, the whole thing. I ask for the entangling surface, and if the bulk is topologically trivial, it seems to me that any point is a zero area of entangling surface, meets the specification.
There's something funny. So let's see.
That was.
The surface that goes through at a constant time in global ADS would be an extremal surface whose boundary is your, is your A, right?
We want a codimension two surface.
So there is no.
Okay, well there is no boundary to your original surface, so there's no boundary to your.
A central point is not codimension.
So you're.
It's the degenerate limit of a codimension two surface. I mean, there's no.
So you're saying
what the definition is.
Okay, so you're saying you need a codimension two surface, which is extremal, and it just shrinks all the way down to a point.
Yeah, why can't I think of that as the.
If I was. It's not the boundary then.
It's not anchored, but he took a surface.
I mean, if you take a little hole in your, in your, in your constant time slice of the sphere, then the extremal surface that's anchored on that little hole that's shrinking to zero is right up at the boundary. So the surface shrinks up towards the boundary as your hole shrinks to zero.
It's
yeah. Yes.
So you don't get very.
Okay, so I get a point on the boundary thing. That's great. That's still
a point on the boundary. How does that tell you about something you're seeing?
Well, draw a picture.
So what Don wants to do is this. He wants to take the cylinder.
Yeah.
And he wants to take
the entire cross section to be. Right.
Okay. And now Veronica can take
A is this entire.
Yeah, that's not good.
But we need a boundary to A. Right?
Yeah, so let's regulate it by making two points here.
Great. Yeah, let me be clear that my region A is the outside, the bigger piece of that.
Bigger piece. Yeah. Okay. So it's entangling W for that would be some little blip.
Okay. And in the limit, it goes out to a point on the boundary.
Yeah.
And the corresponding thing that I think Mark would call W hat of A is in fact the entire space time.
No. It's also the little.
W hat for Mark would be the.
No, because my A is the big piece.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
So I think it's just the span. Yeah.
So you get that, but there's no black hole in that space.
But it would be the inverse, sorry, it would be the Poincaré ADS of that
place. Which the limit of this is that thing shrinks to zero.
But that gives you the Poincaré which not the full global ADS because you don't have the complement of A.
Oh, sorry. You see, it makes a difference whether I first shrink that surface or whether I take the limit of the W hats of A.
Yeah, if you keep a boundary to A, then the
domain dependence always misses some big chunk of the boundary.
Well, so that's an interesting property of this definition is that by taking an arbitrary large. Yeah. Okay.
Because you have one point where you don't know the information.
So I think this just says this is a different question whether you. Take the limit of reduced density matrices as you go outward, or do you take the full density matrix for the full CFT? Those are just different objects, right? And the full density matrix includes an entire Cauchy surface with no holes, has more information in it.
Yes,
sure.
So as we said, it should recover everything up to the singularity in some way.
If you keep a small region, and have your state collapse into a black hole, then these extremal surfaces will do something interesting. I won't be able to draw this, but let me try. So say you form a black hole later, then these extremal surfaces will sort of wrap around the black hole in some fashion. They go on this side, sorry.
Well, they can penetrate the horizon.
They can penetrate the horizon.
But you say they're, no matter what you do with them, as long as they're anchored on the original surface, they're bounded away from the singularity by some.
No, even if they're anchored further up. I mean,
Yeah, you take them.
Yes. When they're anchored there, there's just one extremal surface, a finite set of.
There's some regions you can't probe by any extremal surface anchoring.
So in particular, they would, as you sort of make your region smaller and smaller, they will sort of almost hug some in the, when the black hole gets static, they're almost on the horizon. So you will pick up the thermal part of the entropy. And then there will be these two tails that come back to the region, which will give you the divergent part of that time entropy.
But I guess it's not immediately clear from what's actually in the UBC paper whether they are conjecturing that given the entire state of the CFT, you can reconstruct the entire bulk all the way up to the singularity for collapsing black hole.
They don't say so explicitly, but it's implicit that they think
You can.
There, I think I agree with Ken, that you should be able to.
If you have a density matrix for a region, and you take that region bigger and bigger and bigger, as Don wants to do, so that you're, you know, basically including the entire surface, you know, minus a point, doesn't the density matrix, well, it approaches, or in the limit, becomes the pure state that the system is in, right?
Yes.
So
well, there is a technical issue, which is the following. Again, connected with what I was trying to say with Remy, if you have a subregion, and you're finding the reduced density matrix in that subregion, the way that I would understand that is you take all CFT observables, which are appropriately smooth to be real operators, and which are completely supported inside that region. Okay. So in particular, their support has to vanish the boundary of the region. So if you take the limit of such things, you're looking at operators that in some sense never sample the last point. And this is exactly the issue. This is why, as you say, it's kind of like looking at the point where it packs instead of the full Cauchy surface.
Another way of thinking about this, another way of seeing this is that in this case, if you had a pure state, then the density matrix of the outside and the inside is very equal. So making one bigger or smaller doesn't really help you including more.
The one technical point I would make, though, is that I think if you actually know that there is a well-defined state on the entire slice, then you can just recover things by continuity in some sense. I mean, if the state is such that all of the appropriately smear intervals are continuous, there's not really new information. In the same way, if you're given data in the point array patch, and you know that it really is a solution to the global ADS problem, okay, you have all the information you need. The point array patch does contain what is, from the bulk perspective, a full Cauchy surface. It's just the boundary conditions are different at that last point. Could be different at that last point. So again, if you know that really the thing is defined on the full global ADS, I think this is enough to recover all the information.
One more question. Are you allowed in this context to think about this diamond on the boundary as changing in time? Or is it always considered to be a fixed?
But A is defined at some one time. If you change A, then the
This area on the boundary where things are defined, is that something that is completely fixed for times, or can it evolve?
But it's that direction is the time. So whatever the space-time on the boundary evolves, that's determined by that. If you take A at some later time, then there will be a later causal wedge corresponding to A, and that may have a slightly different shape if the boundary geometry is different. If the boundary geometry is just flat space or it's an static universe, it's always the same.
But then,
we're supposed to be someplace else. We just it's tomorrow.
It's only Thursday.
Maybe I'm
better one.
There is another talk this afternoon.